Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on One Second After when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights. And permits are the exact opposite to private business. Now, why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks? You know, by government agencies like OSHA and the EPA and the State Tax Commissioner, Zoning and Planning and the IRS, and the other swarms of government agents and agencies that are eating out your substance. Well, you know, there's a lot we can do. And the first step is to inform ourselves as to the legal alternatives that we have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about this thing called private business, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first, and let me tell you more about what it is you're not supposed to know about this thing called private business. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, best of all, it's free. And you can call and order one right now. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the archives page and download it right there. That's georgegordon.org. All right, we're talking about EMPs, and we're reviewing a couple of books here. Let me give you the first one here again so that you get this down. Make sure that you get a copy of it. It's called One Second After, William R. Forstchen, F-O-R-S-T-C-H-E-N. Hope I'm pronouncing it anywhere near correct, Forstchen. F-O-R-S-T-C-H-E-N, One Second After. And the second's called Alas, Babylon. It's been out for a while, published first in 1959. Pat Frank is the author. Alas, Babylon, last published in 1993. Probably get both of them at Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com. Third item over here, see if you get this one down. The article is called Nuclear Electromagnetic Pulse, long title. If you just put down EMP, Electromagnetic Pulse, it's put out by Jerry Emanuelson. And the outfit is called futurescience.com, all one word, futurescience.com. All right, now with that out of the way, let's take a look at what Emanuelson has to say. Continuing, he says, a part of the U.S. military system is protected against EMP. Nearly all of the commercial sector is not protected. Most data backups of commercial systems are protected from just about every other threat, but they're not protected against EMP. And most backups are located within the area likely to be affected by the EMP attack. Computer systems and the information that they contain are especially vulnerable. As Max says in the narration in the first episode of the old Dark Angel television series, the electromagnetic pulse turned all the one and zeros into plain old zeros. An EMP attack would literally send thousands of small and mid-sized businesses in the United States into bankruptcy in less than a millisecond. And that's because most of the information that all of our businesses use, I know you know I'm running a business here, and we have just about all of our information on computer. But here's the way that you protect yourself. You back everything up and you put it on disk. Then you put the disks in a Faraday cage just to be safe. Although the disks, they say, are not affected by the EMP pulse, either E1, E2, or E3. So if you had them out sitting on the kitchen table, the EMP pulse comes by, your DVDs and your CDs should survive that. But just to make sure, why don't you back up the information that you've got on your computer, put it in a Faraday box to make sure that it's all protected. Now let me run through this Faraday box for you one more time. I picked up a $35 aluminum, used aluminum case at the Army-Navy store. It's a pretty good size little case. And it's got a handle on it, and it's got a couple of little locks. You know, you can lock the thing up. I don't know what it was designed for. But here's a Faraday cage all of them by itself. It's made out of aluminum, and it's continuous. Now, remember, you can't have gaps in your Faraday cage. You can't have strips of aluminum. It's got to be a completely enclosed aluminum case. Now, you can do this with aluminum foil. For instance, you could have a wooden box, and you could cover that wooden box with aluminum foil, making sure that all the corners are neatly folded and that you've got them all welded together, you know, in such a way, or stuffed together, glued together, pinched together, so that there's no gaps, no holes, no air holes in them. Now, your Faraday cage has to be insulated from the goods that you're protecting inside. So you take your radio and you leave it in the box that it comes in. Wrap the box with aluminum screen from the hardware store. It needs to be aluminum screen or copper screen. Copper screen's more expensive and harder to find. Aluminum screen isn't quite as good, but it's satisfactory or more than satisfactory. So here's your cardboard box wrapped in aluminum screen. Now take that package and stick it into a plastic bag. Now take another aluminum screen and wrap that around the plastic bag. That's your second coating now, separated by a plastic bag from the first coating. That gives you two Faraday cages. Now take that one and put it into another plastic bag, tie it off, stick it into your aluminum satchel or your aluminum box, and then put that one away. And now you've got a Faraday cage within a Faraday cage within a Faraday cage. Now I've stuck mine in my 40-foot container, which is a Faraday cage. And what we're doing here is we're protecting it at two or three levels. If some gets through, then we've got another one to catch it. If that gets through, we've got another one to catch it. Now these microelectronics, the more modern the electrical device, the more modern it is, the smaller it is, and the more vulnerable it is. So tuck that one away in your heart. The older the electrical device, the greater the chances that it's going to survive. Now, although computer hard drives would not be erased, the electronics in hard drives that are not sufficiently protected against EMP would be destroyed, making it very expensive to recover the data that was there and still magnetically stored on the hard drive. And also, some of the data would be completed, or corrupted rather, on any computer hard drives that were spinning at the time of the EMP attack. Nearly all broadcast stations, especially television stations, will go off the air due to the high level of computerized automation. The equipment in most radio and television studios would be so completely destroyed that most commercial radio and television stations would be damaged beyond repair. Radio studios are actually more vulnerable to permanent damage than many portable radio receivers. So keep this one in mind. The radio stations around your area will probably all be damaged, maybe even totally burned out. They'll have to be put together from scratch. But if you've got a radio receiver, AM band radio, you know, there are 50,000 watt stations down on the Mexican border that we can pick up here in the Midwest. And if you've got a shortwave receiver, hell, you can pick up shortwave from Australia and New Zealand on some clear nights. Now, the government will be back in business in short order. I mean, the Army and the Navy, you know, those people, they've got transmitters, they've got radio equipment. They will be back on the air with the emergency broadcast system, if nothing else. And you need a receiver. That's what the bottom line is. You need some kind of a receiver. And the receiver that I picked up, two of them, are hand crank. It takes about 60 seconds to crank it up, and then it'll run for 30 minutes. So I get 30 minutes of reception, 30 minutes of broadcast time, no batteries, and we don't plug it in. Neatest little thing I ever saw. It came out of South Africa. I don't know what we paid for them, probably $100 a piece or something like that, about two. Leave them in the box and put a screen around them, aluminum screen, stick it in a plastic bag, put another aluminum screen around it, put another plastic bag, stick it in your Faraday cage, and you should be in pretty good condition to protect your radio. Now, in the current situation, broadcast television transmitters would actually be more easily repairable than studio equipment. With the transition to digital television broadcasting here in the United States, the digital encoders would be the extremely weak link in the fragile digital television broadcast chain. And it's likely that a few FM stations could get back on the air within a week or so of an EMP attack if emergency broadcasts were originated from the FM transmitter sites. But they would only be on the air until fuel for their generator ran out, and then some generators would be destroyed by the poles. A nuclear EMP attack would likely make a permanent change the structure of television broadcasting in the United States, since it would not be financially feasible to rebuild most local television stations, except possibly in the largest cities. The television broadcast rebuild would probably be with a satellite and cable infrastructure, with local news being provided by a subsidiary of national news companies over their national, freshly EMP-hardened post-pulse infrastructure. I guess we're presuming that after the EMP attack, then we'll start hardening. I don't know where we're going to get the equipment to harden them after the fact, if you're not going to do it before the fact when the stuff is readily available. In all, fiber optic internet would assume greater or greatly increased importance. Making predictions about what a post-pulse world would be like is very difficult, though, since a severe EMP would cause a level of destruction to the electrical and electronic infrastructure that would make the United States incapable of supporting anything close to its present population. In the old Dark Angel television series, an EMP attack is supposed to have occurred on June 1, 2009. And the vehicles appear to be mostly pre-1980 and post-2009 models. There's a good reason for this. Many conventional gasoline vehicles produced since about 1980 may not function after an EMP attack due to their dependence upon electronics. This would obviously produce a huge problem for the United States after an EMP attack. Merely moving disabled vehicles off the road would be a major undertaking. Disabled traffic lights would add to the traffic problems. In one episode of Future Weapons Seasons, which was broadcast in 2006, a Ford Taurus driven onto a nuclear EMP simulator in New Mexico and pulsed. You can buy the DVD from the Discovery Channel, but you have to buy the entire 2006 Future Weapons series, which does include more information on EMP, or you can see what happened to the Ford Taurus in this video excerpt on YouTube. Many of the effects of nuclear EMP are very difficult to predict in the 21st century United States of America. Many vehicles that one would expect to be disabled by an EMP due to their dependence on sensitive electronics might be shielded well enough to continue to operate. Automotive electronic ignition systems in general are much better shielded and protected against EMP than other electronics. After all, the purpose of an electronic ignition is to make high voltage sparks. Circuits in the automobile outside of the electronic ignition are actually the most vulnerable. Actual tests on vehicles in simulators have been very inconsistent. Even if only 10% of the automobiles on the highways during the day were abruptly disabled, the resultant traffic jams would be nearly incomprehensible. Having 10% of the cars suddenly disabled might actually be more chaotic than having nearly all of them suddenly disabled. Of course, there's no practical way to do a real nuclear EMP test. Even a nuclear test in space over the Pacific would likely do billions of dollars in damage to today's electrical and electronic infrastructure in the Pacific region. Tests done on 37 vehicles that used electronic ignition systems by the United States EMP Commission showed that all of the tested cars would still run after a simulated EMP, although most sustained some, mostly nuisance electronics damage. Now remember, your car's surrounded by steel. Now let me tell you what a guy laid on us one time. He said, if you want to protect your car, assuming you're not out on the road now, get yourself one of these metal, aluminum metal carports and ground it. And then take and put a floor in it and put steel on the floor, or aluminum would be better, so that the car is sitting on the aluminum, which is hooked to the sides of the carport. You need to extend the walls of the carport down to the metal on the floor. In other words, you're going to build a Faraday cage called a garage out of aluminum, out of a carport, with metal on the floor, all connected around and grounded. Now you've got a Faraday cage to put your car in. And if the event transpires while your car is in there, it'll probably survive it. Reports about the effects of the 1962 Starfish Prime test that have been declassified in recent years state that some of the automobiles in Hawaii had their old non-electric ignition systems damaged by the EMP. So automobile damage may be much higher than we previously thought. Most of the people whose cars were damaged by the Starfish Prime test probably never related their car ignition problems to the nuclear test. The damage to diesel generators in the 1962 test in the Soviet Union indicates that some of the electrical damage doesn't show up right away. Although many people would like to know exactly which vehicles would continue to function after an EMP, the number of variables are enormous and includes the orientation of the vehicle with respect to the detonation point at the particular time that the device is detonated. Even for vehicles that are not disabled by an EMP attack, some very bizarre things might happen. And I've had the experience myself of getting locked out of my vehicle at a mountaintop transmitter site by RF fields. In that case, RF, electromagnetic energy from high power transmitters, caused the doors to lock while the keys were in the ignition and the engine was running. Of course, this occurred during one of the few times that I didn't have an extra set of keys with me. I've also heard of windshield wipers suddenly coming on in recent model vehicles when driven near high power radio transmitters. In addition to the large area, nearly continent-wide effect of nuclear EMP attacks, there is an imminent threat from much smaller electromagnetic weapons that could do only localized damage. Many of these are relatively easy to construct and are very likely to be used in coming years in the United States by terrorists or as well as by ordinary vandals. An electromagnetic truck bomb in a small truck or van would not necessarily destroy the truck, which might be able to drive away, but could do millions of dollars in damage to the computer systems inside of a building. There is a non-nuclear means of EMP generation. An example of a non-nuclear EMP device is the one being marketed by Eureka Aerospace, which is described with a video at the FizOrg site. And these devices are designed to destroy the vital electronics in automobiles, Although these devices can be beneficial in many cases, in the wrong hands, they could cause enormous destruction at the rate of millions of dollars in damage per hour. A nuclear EMP attack would knock out most, if not all, of the electric power grid. The extent of the electrical grid damage would depend upon the size of the bomb. Full repair of the power grid would take anywhere from 2 months to 3 years or more. Many components, such as large transformers, which are normally resistant to large voltage transients, would be destroyed by the DC current induced by the E3 component of the pulse when they are connected to very long copper wires. The design life of the transformers in the United States power grid is 40 years, but the average age of these transformers is already more than 42 years. If power companies were to keep adequate spare parts on hand, the repair time could be kept closer to the two-month time frame. Adequate parts are not currently being kept on hand, and in most cases, there are very long lead times for replacement parts for the electrical grid if the parts are not kept on hand by the electric utility. There is currently no United States manufacturing capability for these large power transformers in its power grid. All of these extremely heavy transformers have to be manufactured and imported from other countries. The current delivery times for these transformers is 3 years from the time that the order is placed. Now, that widespread destruction of these transformers would completely overwhelm the very limited worldwide production capacity of these very specialized generators, or transformers, rather. The problem of spare parts affects more than just the power grid. There has been an overall trend during the past decade toward all enterprises keeping fewer and fewer critical spare parts on hand. This is called just-in-time delivery. Electrical and communications lines carried on overhead poles would be most susceptible to EMP. Although fiber optic lines will not pick up EMP-induced currents, as the Soviet Union learned in 1962, underground telephone and electrical lines would not be completely immune. Now, a big problem in the United States would be the electronic communication system. The threat of an EMP attack is well known to the people who could do something about it. In one major study in 2004 by the U.S. federal government, they stated that several potential adversaries have or can acquire the capability to attack the United States with a high-altitude nuclear weapon, generated electromagnetic pulse. A determined adversary can achieve an EMP attack and an attack capability without having a high level of sophistication. So evidently, this is a very reasonable or simple technology. EMP is one of a small number of threats that can hold our society at risk of catastrophic consequences. EMP will cover the wide geographic region with line of sight to the nuclear weapon. It has the capability to produce significant damage to critical infrastructures and thus to the very fabric of U.S. society, as well as to the ability of the United States and Western nations to project influence and military power. The common element that can produce such an impact from EMP is primarily electronics. So pervasive in all aspects of our society and military, coupled through critical infrastructures, our vulnerability is increasing daily as our use of and dependence upon electronics continues to grow. Now, the impact of EMP is asymmetric in relation to potential protagonists who are not as dependent on modern electronics. The current vulnerability of our critical infrastructures can both invite and reward attack if not corrected. Correction is feasible and will within the nation's means and resources to accomplish. In 2008, a study was issued by the United States EMP Commission that has turned out to be the most comprehensive and valuable analysis of the current EMP threat written so far. This highly recommended report is available at, if you'll go to www.futurescience.com, and then there's a number here that follows, slash A, no 8 in there, just A, 2473-EMP. commission.pdf. So there's the source for that 180-page report. All right, now note this. It's a 200-page report. It's about 17 megabytes of material and could take a half hour or more to download if you're on a slow dial-up connection. The original source for the report is at www.empcommission.org. /docs/A2473-EMP-Commission-7MB-PDF. It'll give you the code. There's two of them there for that 180 or 200 page report to the Congress on this EMP problem. Now, you can just about bet that private industry isn't going to jump on this. This is something that's been around now for 30 years. Well, hell, it's been here since 1962. The Russians and Americans both discovered it the same year. It's a potent weapon. It's a potent problem. And one of these days, on one side or the other is going to use it. And I suspect it'll be the other side that uses it against us first. Now, this report is a PDF that requires the free Adobe Acrobat PDF reader. The report of about 200 pages is somewhat technical in some areas, but it's very objective and it is a very comprehensive report. As the above report points out, even if power grid transformers survive an EMP attack, the power grid is extremely vulnerable to EMP and other attacks because of control and monitoring devices called SCADAS, which would be easily knocked out even with a relatively small weapon. Now, for a shorter summary, the comments of the chairman of the EMP Commission made when the report above was delivered to the U.S. Congress are summarized here in 7 pages. For a large amount of additional information about EMP, including many eyewitness accounts of nuclear EMP detonations, then see Effects of Nuclear Weapons Tests, : Scientific Facts. Again, that's Effects of Nuclear Weapons Tests, : Scientific Facts. Another good report on the nuclear EMP problem is the report on electromagnetic pulse threats in 2010, released by the United States Air Force. A new book was released in March of 2009 about a fictional EMP attack on the United States. That book has already done much to educate people about EMP threats. It's called 1 Second After by William R. Forston, a best-selling author who has a Ph.D. in military history from Purdue University. The book covers the period of time from the afternoon of the pulse attack until exactly 1 year after the attack. The book has been optioned by Warner Brothers for development into a motion picture, and a trade paperback edition of the book recently, edited by the author, was released in late November. At the time that the trade paperback was released, the hardcover edition still had all of the original editing mistakes that were corrected in the trade paperback edition. Now, Dr. Forshin's book is quite technically accurate, although it probably oversimplifies the EMP effect on automobiles. In his defense, though, Dr. Forshin didn't have access to the latest EMP automobile simulator test information when he wrote the book. The contract for the book was actually completed in early 2006. The earlier EMP automobile data was much more dismal, and there are still a great many uncertainties about the EMP effect on automobiles because of the very small number of vehicles that have actually been tested. The 1962 Soviet experiments with the replacement or with the repeated burnout of military diesel generators using no solid-state electronics is a warning not to rely too heavily on simulator testing. It is important to remember that the last time an automobile was actually tested against a real nuclear EMP was back in 1962. Actual electromagnetic damage in the real world is far messier than any simulations would indicate. Now, the EMP Commission's testing of automobiles was only done up to a level of 50,000 volts per meter. The EMP Commission did not take the level up to see at what level the automobiles would fail to run. From everything that is published is open, non-classified, English-language scientific papers. 50,000 volts per meter is about the maximum electric field strength that can be produced by first and second generation nuclear weapons of any size. However, EMP Commission staff members have stated in sworn testimony before the U.S. Congress that super EMP weapons have been developed by more than one country that are capable of generating up to 200,000 volts per meter below the detonation and 100,000 volts per meter at the horizon. Now, for more information about super EMP weapons, see the super-EMP page. Now, this book, 1 Second After, postulates an EMP from a missile launched from an offshore container ship. If anyone thinks that this is an unrealistic scenario, take a look at this advertisement from a Russian company with an included YouTube video that looks like it could be a scene out of the 1 Second After movie. Now, there's the story. Now, that article, again, is entitled Nuclear Electromagnetic Pulse. The author is Jerry Emanuelson. Well done. Well documented. And it comes from www.futurescience.com. Okay, one down. Halfway point. I've got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, non-state schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc in the law. Our website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Now, once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. And if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and they'll give you that access to that free general law CD package. Download it right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, I've been giving you the name and number here of the two books that we're reviewing, A Last Babylon by Pat Frank. Both of these now are fictional stories depicting the probable effects of a nuclear attack. In our subsistence and survival school, we spend quite a bit of time on this thing of nuclear attack. For you people living in the cities, your chances of surviving a nuclear attack are surprisingly good. And that's because if you take a city, you know, such as San Francisco, for instance, the bomb is going to be dropped, and if it's a surface explosion, it isn't good, depending upon the size of it, of course. All of you people living in the outlying areas, such as over in Marin County or south of San Francisco, you know, Burlingame on south, San Jose, across the bay, all the people on the other side of the Berkeley Hills, those people will all survive. Well, at least the initial blast. Now, it's very unlikely that you're going to have a 20-megaton nuclear blast, is what we were talking about back in the 50s, you know. You'll probably have about a 1 megaton or a 0.5 megaton nuclear blast, and probably an airburst. And I got to thinking about this EMP, and I think that this EMP is a better strategy, much better strategy. It doesn't tear up all the infrastructure. No, sure, you got to come back and rebuild it, but you know, you don't destroy anything. This is what they were talking about back in the 60s when they came out with a thing called the neutron bomb. Now, remember our enemies in China and Russia. They have never given up on their quest or their agenda to take over the world. And to do that, they've got to displace the United States of America, and we're god-awful, vulnerable. And then we got an Achilles heel. We've got our God working against us, and he says he's going to destroy us. And I showed you that the other day. We're taking a look at Ezekiel chapter 5 and Ezekiel chapter 6. And then Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, Revelation 6, Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21. You know, all these chapters, you know, are aimed right here at the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. You know, we're the target in the crosshairs. So now with that in mind, I got another short story here that I want to share with you here on science from NASA. NASA, listen to this. On May 29th, 2009, an international panel of experts led by NOAA, that's the National Ocean and Atmospheric something or other, and sponsored by NASA has released a new prediction for the next solar cycle. Solar cycle 24 will peak, they say, in May of 2013 with a below-average number of sunspots. If our prediction is correct, solar cycle 24 will have a peak sunspot number of 90, the lowest of any cycle since 1928, when solar cycle 16 peaked at 78, says panel chairman Doug Bleisacker of the NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center. Now, at Wright, a solar flare observed in December of 2006 by the NOAA GOES-13 satellite. It is tempting to describe such a cycle as weak or mild, but that could give the wrong impression. Even a below-average cycle is capable of producing severe space weather, points out Bleisacker, the great geomagnetic storm of 1859, for instance, occurred during a solar cycle of about the same size that we're predicting for 2013. So this Carrington effect of 1859 didn't come about because of some super cycle, or, you know, some super activity on the sun. It happened to just an average one. These sunspots, when they develop, they're totally unpredictable. So this sunspot now that created the Carrington effect in 1859 knocked out the telegraph of the day. And today, we're 1,000 times, 100,000 times more susceptible. Even a below-average cycle is capable of producing severe space weather. In 1859, the storm known as the Carrington effect, after astronomer Richard Carrington, who witnessed the instigating solar flare, electrified transmission cables, set fires in telegraph offices, and produced northern lights so bright that people could read newspapers by their red and green glow. A recent report by the National Academy of Sciences found that if a similar storm occurred today, it would cause $2 trillion in damages to society's high-tech infrastructure and require 4 to 10 years for complete recovery. For comparison, Hurricane Katrina caused only $125 billion in damage. So we're talking about $100 billion in damage versus $2,000 billion in damage in today's dollars compared to Hurricane Katrina, which was a pretty good-sized natural disaster. Now above, this plot of sunspot number shows the measured peak of the last solar cycle in blue and predicted peak of the next solar cycle in red. The credit goes to the NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center. The latest forecast revises an earlier prediction issued in 2007, and at that time, a sharply divided panel believed that solar minimum would come in March of 2008, followed by either a strong solar maximum in 2011 or a weak solar maximum in 2012. Competing models gave different answers, and researchers were eager for the sun to reveal which was correct. Turns out that none of our models were totally correct, says Dean Pasnell of the Goddard Space Flight Center, NASA's lead representative on the panel. The sun is behaving in an unexpected and very interesting way. Researchers have known about the solar cycle since the mid-1800s, and graphs of sunspot numbers resemble a roller coaster going up and down with an approximately 11-year period. At first glance, it looks like a regular pattern, but predicting the peaks and valleys has proven very troublesome. Cycles vary in length from about 9 to 14 years. Some peaks are high, others are low. The valleys are usually brief, lasting only a couple of years. But sometimes they stretch out much longer. Now, in the 17th century, the sun plunged into a 70-year period of spotlessness known as the Maunder Minimum that still baffles scientists to this day. The Maunder Minimum. Right now, the solar cycle is in a valley, the deepest in the past century. In 2008-09, the sun set space age records for low sunspot count, very weak solar wind, and very low solar radiance. The sun has gone more than 2 years without a significant solar flare. In our professional careers, we've never seen anything quite like it, says Pasnell. Solar minimum has lasted far beyond the date that we predicted in 2007. In recent months, however, the sun has begun to show timorous signs of life. Small sunspots and proto-sunspots are popping up with increasing frequency, and enormous currents of plasma on the sun's surface, these are called zonal flows, are gaining strength and slowly drifting toward the sun's equator. Radio astronomers have detected a tiny but significant uptick in solar radio emissions. All these things are precursors to an awakening solar cycle number 24 and form the basis for the panel's new unanimous forecast. According to the forecast, the sun should remain generally calm for at least one more year. From a research point of view, that's good news because solar minimum has proven to be more interesting than anyone imagined. Low solar activity has a profound effect on Earth's atmosphere, allowing it to cool and contract. Space junk accumulates in Earth orbit because there is less aerodynamic drag, and the becalmed solar wind whips up fewer magnetic storms around the Earth's magnetic poles. Cosmic rays that are normally pushed back by solar wind instead intrude on the near-Earth environment. There are other side effects, too, that can be studied only so long as the sun remains quiet. All right, so there's that story. Now, space storm alert, 90 seconds from catastrophe. This is also New Scientist, March 23rd, 2009. So if you'll go to the New Scientist webpage. Now, I don't have an address here on this article, but it's entitled Space Storm Alert, 90 Seconds from Catastrophe. It's midnight on the 22nd of September 2012, and the skies above Manhattan are filled with a flickering curtain of colorful light. Few New Yorkers have seen the aurora this far south, but their fascination is short-lived. Within a few seconds, electric bulbs dim and flicker, then become unusually bright for a fleeting moment. Then all the lights in the state go out. Within 90 seconds, the entire eastern half of the United States is without power. A year later, and millions of Americans are dead and the nation's infrastructure lies in tatters. The World Bank declares America is a developing nation. Europe, Scandinavia, China, and Japan are also struggling to recover from the same fateful event, a violent storm, 150 million kilometers away on the surface of the sun. Well, now, that sounds ridiculous. Surely, the sun couldn't create so profound a disaster on Earth, and yet, an extraordinary report funded by NASA and issued by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences in January of this year claims that it could do just that. And over the last few decades, Western civilizations have busily sown the seeds of their own destruction. Our modern way of life, with its reliance upon technology, has unwittingly exposed us to an extraordinary danger. Plasma balls spewed from the surface of the sun could wipe out our power grids with catastrophic consequences. The projections of just how catastrophic make chilling reading. We're moving closer and closer to the edge of a possible disaster, says Daniel Baker, a space weather expert based at the University of Colorado in Boulder and chair of the NAS committee responsible for the report. Now keep in mind here that what we're dealing with is kind of like Bible prophecy. It's kind of like talking about the second coming. We know it's coming at some point in time, but we don't know when. And we've been expecting it for 2,000 years. It hasn't come yet. Every day that goes by brings us closer to the event, but we're not sure when the event is going to transpire. We're pretty sure that it's going to happen, but we don't know. Don't know when. Now, this event has already occurred once. It occurred in 1859. It's probably occurred many times prior to that, but nobody ever noticed. There wouldn't be any reason to notice solar flares or aurora borealis because it doesn't do anything if you're not dealing with electrical currents and electrical outputs. But now, all of us are dependent upon electricity. We're all dependent upon microelectronics, the digital era. Think about it. Go into Walmart. Imagine a Walmart store when the power goes out. Now try to buy something. They can't make change. Their cash registers don't work. They can't order anything because it's all done digitally by computer. Most of the girls that work there in the Walmart store can't even count change. If the cash register didn't tell them how much the change was, they couldn't figure it out. Now, the time was in the past when we had a cash drawer, or we had an old national cash register, and we would ring it up. It was manual. You turn the crank, you open the drawer, you can make change. You'd write it down on a 3x5 card, and you'd order some more tomorrow. That isn't the way business is done, not in this country. And it isn't just Walmart, it's everybody. Now, go out and try to buy a tank of gas. So you drive over to the Walmart gas station. It's out. There's no power. They can't pump gas out of the ground. Now, what are we going to do? Now, that's assuming that our car is running. We might walk out of the Walmart store, pitch black, get in our car, and find out the car won't start. Now you're at the Walmart store. You couldn't buy anything when you got in there. Couldn't get any gas. Your car doesn't start. And you're 9 miles from home. You're going to have to huff it home, aren't you? When you walk home 9 miles later, and you find that your house is blacked out, and there isn't anything in your house that works, including the water. Remember, the water has to be pumped. And without electricity, there's no water. You probably need heat. If your heat is coming from a fan in your furnace, you got no electricity to run the fan, even if you had a wood stove or coal and could build a fire. Now, your computers don't work. Your electric lights don't work. Your water doesn't work. Your refrigerator and freezers are all off. You've got enough food in your house for a few days. Picture this scenario, because that's what's coming down. Now, we've been talking about this electric grid going out, but in times past, when I brought this subject up, based upon what I'd seen in the reports that I'd seen come across my desk here, they were talking about the electric grid going out accidentally and then tripping off the next power station and the next power station and the next one until the whole grid went down nationwide. Compared to this EMP attack, you know, that's small potatoes. They could handle something like that. They figured it would take 30 days to get it all back up and running. But remember, to get it back up and running takes electricity. Now, there will be electric power plants on. If it got tripped off accidentally like that, you know, where a substation screws up. This happened up in, I think it was Quebec. The Canadians started the ball rolling. Something tripped off up there, and it cascaded down to the next one, and it tripped it off and cascaded down to the next one. They finally got it stopped in Ohio, knocked out about 4, 5, 6 states. Got it back up and running in a few hours. But here's the moral of the story. They said then, this was back about 2003, I guess it was, they said then that if that thing had tripped off all the way over to California, it would have taken 30 days to get that thing back up and running. Now, remember in the last program I brought this subject up. You know, if this thing goes out, it takes power to start up a power plant. So when they shut a power plant down for repairs, when they go to start it up, they rely upon the power coming off the grid to start that thing back up. What do you do at a power plant that doesn't have any electrical power? How do you start it up? And after 30 or 60 or 90 days, all the power plants in the country are going to be shut down. If this thing goes on for what they're talking about, 3 months or 4 months to 2 years, if you're going to order these transformers, you know, from China and other countries around the world and bring all this stuff back in here and set it back up, and you're going to start these power plants up one at a time, that's going to be quite a little trick. Nobody's ever done that before. There isn't anybody here that really knows or could tell us, you know, well, here's the way we do this, and here's what, how long it's going to take. It's kind of like Y2K. This is it's an imponderable hanging out here. We've never been through it before, and we don't know how it's going to work. But based upon Y2K, most people would say, oh, it's a phony baloney problem, and I'm not going to prepare for it. And that's the average guy, you'd say, woman. I'm not convinced that that's going to happen. Now, the projections of just how catastrophic make chilling reading. We're moving closer and closer to the edge of this possible disaster. It's hard to conceive of the sun wiping out a large amount of our hard-earned progress. Nevertheless, it is possible, and the surface of the sun is a roiling mass of plasma, charged high-energy particles, some of which escape the surface and travel through space as the solar wind. From time to time, that wind carries a billion-ton glob of plasma, a fireball, known as a corneal mass ejection. If one should hit the Earth in its magnetic shield, the result could be truly devastating. We saw it happen once in 1859. Well, that's where that story is at. Let me put a mark here in the margin. We'll take it up right there next time. Talking about EMP. Remember, Last Babylon is the name of one book that you want. Pat Frank is the author. The second one is called One Second After, and the author's name is William R. Forschen, F-O-R-S-T-C-H-E-N. Well, let's see here. Where's my paper? Let's see if I can give you a final readout here. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. I've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.